Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes of business owners across the land, coming to you remotely. I guess, Hector, I don't even know where you are.
I'm in, actually right now, New Berlin, Wisconsin.
New Berlin, Wisconsin. All right. You're in New Berlin, Wisconsin. I'm just outside of Madison, Wisconsin. But we're coming to you digitally through the Sun Prairie Media Center, underwritten by Bank of Sun Prairie. That puts us pretty much anywhere on the web that people are landing on. My name is James Kademan, entrepreneur, author, speaker, and helpful coach to small business owners across the country. And today we're welcoming slash preparing to learn from Hector Colin, the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan, as well as, this is the fun part here, seven-time national boxing champion. So Hector, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. So happy to be here with you. And just one little correction. My last name is Colon. So Hector Colon. Thank you so much.
Colon, like yes. What you put on to smell nice.
There you go. There you go.
That was my mistake.
Oh, that's all right.
Normally I ask people how to pronounce their name, and I dropped the ball there. So I'm sorry about that. We'll fix it.
That's okay.
For the end here. So Hector, you're president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services here in Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. How long have you been doing that?
I've been in this role for 3 years now.
Okay. And how did you land in that role?
Yeah, so I was, I used to be the director of Health and Human Services for Milwaukee County.
Okay.
And while I was in that role, that was a great job. I worked with the team there to turn multi-million dollar deficits into multi-million dollar surpluses and
wow,
really made a huge difference in the lives of many. And that was a very hard job.
Yeah.
And from there, the board chair of Lutheran Social Services approached me and said, hey, everywhere I turn, people say I need to speak with you. I got this president and CEO position available. Would you like to talk? So we talked, we had a glass of wine and discussed the position, and 1 hour meeting turned into 2 hour meeting. And he went home to his wife, and he tells me now that he told his wife, if this were my company, I would hire Hector on the spot. But we did go through a pretty robust 6 month process in order to land as the president and CEO. But I thought it was a great process because it really allowed us to both feel that this was a great fit on both sides. And I'm honored and humbled to be in this role right now.
That's super cool. That's super cool that they came to you. So you didn't even necessarily have to apply for it.
Well, I mean, I did. They came to me to initiate an interview process with me. There were other candidates that were involved in the process. I just surfaced as the number one candidate and they offered me the job. But again, it was a 6 month process.
Sure. That is super cool.
Yes. So yes.
Did you expect to climb the ladder, so to speak?
Yeah. I always had an ambition, to be a president and CEO of an organization, and specifically a nonprofit organization, considering I was a product of the United Community Center that helped me early in my life through boxing program, through baseball. And then I worked there as the associate executive director in my career. So I always was interested in becoming a president and CEO of a nonprofit organization. And I couldn't have asked for a better organization to serve. Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan has been around for over 138 years.
Wow.
Providing great services, last year serving over 39,000 individuals in Wisconsin and Upper Michigan, over 91% of which have indicated that we have improved their quality of life. So just the history, the legacy, the quality of this organization, I would argue is second to none. And again, I'm so humbled and honored that I can serve in this wonderful organization.
You know, it's interesting to hear you speak about Lutheran Social Services, because I'm thinking back, pushing 8 years ago, my wife and I started going down the road of adoption through Lutheran Social Services.
Oh, blessing.
Yeah,
did you finalize the process?
We went very far and then my wife ended up getting pregnant the old fashioned way. after doing a 5-year battle with that.
Okay.
So it was interesting because we went awfully far down that road. We made the portfolio. I don't even remember what they called it. Mm-hmm. We went a lot, and we threw you guys some money. And I remember having this conversation with my wife, because she had found out she was pregnant, and she had a few miscarriages there. And so she's like, we're about to do the home inspection. Where okay. The person comes to make sure that we don't have a bunch of guns and axes on the wall or something like that. Smoke alarms and all that jazz. And we had to pay, I don't know, $5,000, something like that. And she's like, what do we do? Do we cancel it or do we go through with it? And I said, essentially, we hedge. So we pay the money. And if we end up not going through, we consider it's money going to a good cause. And it went to a good cause. So.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I love hearing those stories of individuals that have been impacted by LSS in one way or another. And and in your case, through the adoption program, I hear many of those stories all across the state, individuals that have been adopted through LSS. And or it could be individuals that them or a family member struggles with addiction or mental health challenges, and LSS has been there to serve them with love, with care, to really help them with their challenges. So just so many wonderful stories that I've been blessed to hear. Thank you for sharing yours.
Yeah. Can you, I guess, just for myself and the listeners here, what all does Lutheran Social Services do? You have a huge gamut, right?
Yes. We're in about 60 counties in the state of Wisconsin, and then also serve part of the Upper Michigan. We're about $60 million in revenue with about 800 staff, and staff that are humble servant leaders that lead with compassion and great hearts to serve a child in crisis who has nowhere to turn, a family in turmoil that might be facing eviction, someone struggling with addiction or a mental health challenge, or an elderly person that needs just a little bit of assistance to live independently and successfully in their home, or a refugee that's fleeing from war and persecution. LSS has been the place for these individuals to turn to for over 138 years and still going.
Wow. Yeah. So you have locations, 60 counties. That seems like you cover most of Wisconsin, I imagine.
Yep. Most of Wisconsin. There's just only a few counties way up north and west that we're not in right now, but pretty much serve the whole state.
Sure. So, has Lutheran Social Services been in Wisconsin that whole 138 years?
That's correct. Yes. There are Lutheran Social Service organizations across the country. I believe there's probably about half of the states have an LSS, that organization in those states. Now we're all independently run, so it's not kind of like a franchise or anything like that. But we do collaborate. There is an association called Lutheran Social Services of America, where we get together and share best practices and try to support one another and develop relationships. But we're all independently run and have our own mission statements.
Each individual has their own mission statement.
Yeah, we're all, yes.
Interesting. So how would you say that your group differs from maybe a Minnesota chapter or something like that?
Yeah, actually the Minnesota, I'd say we're pretty similar. Actually, they're a great organization, and all of them are. So we're pretty similar in terms of the number of services that we have and the programs that we provide. It's pretty, housing, behavioral health, refugee services, adoption. Those are very common pretty much across the board with all the other organizations. So really very similar, programs that we run.
Okay. All right. I want to downshift a little bit to the boxing thing, if you don't mind.
Yes.
So you came out with a memoir.
Yeah.
Right? From boxing ring to boardroom, which is pretty cool.
Yes, thank you.
So is this out now, or is this still being published?
Yep. So very newly released. Actually, we're going through pre-orders right now.
Oh, nice.
And we have about 700 books in our pre-sales in just a few weeks. Wow. So that's going very, very well. But yeah, the books will be in hand. They're actually going to print right now. So they'll be in hand probably the end of this month or the first week of September is really the goal. So on my website, HectorColonMKE.com is the vehicle for individuals to purchase the book. So that's just the title is My Journey from Boxing Ring to Boardroom, Five Essential Virtues to Life and Leadership. And those five essential virtues are magnanimity, which is really striving for greatness. Humility, in the context of my book, is really about serving others. Courage, which is about facing your fears and doing the right thing, even when it's hard. And perseverance, which is about not giving up and actually going, encouraging people to go out there and fail. Because when you fail, you learn a lot. And the last virtue is temperance, which is about self-control and restraint. So in my memoir, I kind of give, you know, from being bullied as a young child that led me to the boxing ring and learning all those virtues and eventually becoming the president and CEO in the boardroom at LSS.
That's cool. So tell me, let's start with the whole you being bullied thing. So yeah. I guess, is that high school? Is it junior high, middle school, something like that, or younger?
At a very young age. So I was one of three Latino families on my block. It was a heavily Polish neighborhood when we were growing up. And there was one particular family that didn't want us there. And I recall that one summer day going out to play baseball with some of the kids. And one kid called me a spick, the N-word, and said, get out of our neighborhood now. And I tried to talk to the individual. I said, hey, I want to play baseball with you. And then all of a sudden he hit me in the nose. I walked home with a bloody nose crying. And as I entered the house, the first person I saw was my father. And I immediately saw tears in his eyes. And this is a man that doesn't cry. And right away he said, ¿Qué te pasó? What happened? And I told him, and we ended up going to the family and talking with them a little bit more about this. I recall my father saying, look, I want this to stop. We went back home, and my father said, I'm going to take you to the gym so that you can learn how to defend yourself. And I recall going to the gym, United Community Center, and my boxing coach put me in front of the mirror. And he showed me some combinations, and he told my father right away, your son is a natural. He's going to become a champion. And obviously, as a young kid, that lifted up my, boosted my self-esteem. And I was kind of excited about him saying that. And he was right. I ended up becoming a 7-time national champion, 6 different weight classes, and traveling all over the world with the United States national boxing team. And in 1992, I was favored to go to the Olympics in Barcelona, Spain. And here I am. I was 19 years old. I was so excited. But the biggest opportunity of my life, I was not focused. Mm-hmm. I was looking past the Olympics. Okay, I'm going to win the gold medal. I'm going to sign a lucrative contract. I'm going to be a millionaire. And I also was... had some unproductive relationships at the time, and I entered the ring and I lost.
Oh no!
And even to this day, there's that little pinch in the heart because I know I shouldn't have lost. I should have made the Olympics, but everything happens for a reason. So during that time, I was hurting and I was searching because I wasn't. Those big time promoters that were saying we're going to make millions, they weren't calling me. And so on December 27, 1992, I bought my first Bible. And on that day, I gave my life to Christ. 6 months later, I fight the same guy, Jesse Brasino. This time I knock him out in the first round for the U.S. Championship. that fight was on cable television. I was on the front cover of USA Boxing Magazine, inside cover of Sports Illustrated, and the promoter started coming back. But I put it through a year of prayer, discernment, and ended up feeling a strong calling away from the sport. Toughest decision I ever made in my life. But that same dedication, determination, and discipline it took me to be a champion boxer is the same dedication, determination, and discipline I apply into my life and really striving for excellence in whatever it is, whether it be as a husband, as a father, or a CEO. I have that drive from boxing.
So when you walked away from boxing, were you mid-20s, something like that?
I was essentially 21. So not
even started.
Not even at my prime. That's right. And I walked away. And, you know, the one thing I could tell you is it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I ended up beating Vernon Forrest, who is a four-time world champion. I beat Jose Antonio Rivera, who was, ended up becoming a three-time world champion, and both of them millionaires. And I gave that up, but I'll tell you what I have. I have my brains, at least a little bit. It did probably get impacted a little bit.
Fair, totally fair.
But I have my brains. I have a beautiful family that I probably would have never have had if I would have entered, if I would have went the professional route. I have a great career and been blessed to be in a position where I can impact others in a very positive way. So I feel so blessed, both because of my boxing experiences, which really helped me to be the person that I am today, but also walking away from the sport with grace and all that I learned from boxing that really I'm just so grateful for.
When you're at the gym with other boxers, do you see the majority of them doing what you did and kind of walking away after a certain point, realizing that there's a price to pay for being successful in boxing? And yeah. Brain damage is a lot of it, I guess, or is a risk. So do you find people walking away from it, or do you find people just pushing until they realize they're not winning? Or how do people leave boxing, I guess, from your experience?
Well, I think it depends. Honestly, I can tell you, honestly, I don't know anybody who has achieved as much as I have achieved and just walked away from the sport. Wow. So I don't know. I just don't know anybody who has done that. People will leave the sport because they realize maybe they're not good enough to take it to that level and they get out of it. Or, maybe they got really hurt. And it was a little bit of a wake up call for them to say, wow, you know, I could really get hurt in this sport. So there's lots of reasons why, or people just, they find a different passion that they have. And none of those reasons were the case for me. I just fundamentally believe in my heart, actually, after reading 1 Corinthians, in Corinthians, where it says, we're temples of the Holy Spirit. What we do to ourselves, we do unto God. And I had pictured myself in the ring with a temple of the Holy Spirit. I also am a temple and I'm going in there to hurt the person. And I could get hurt as well. And there, it just presented a conflict for me that I ended up not feeling comfortable with. And again, it was the hardest decision I ever made in my life. It really hurt a lot of people. My coach, Israel Acosta, we call Shorty, who is truly a giant. He's been a giant in my life and in the lives of so many individuals, but the hurt and pain it caused both of us as we went through that process was an experience, but something we feel was the right. Now in hindsight, where I am today and all the blessings that have come into my life, we knew it was the right decision.
All right. That's cool. That's cool. It's interesting. Yeah. So tell me, I guess I didn't realize that you were in 6 different weight classes. That alone is monumental. How big of a range are we talking here?
Yeah, from 106 all the way on to 147.
I'd call it
147 was my last championship title.
Okay.
And that was in 1993.
Wow. So were you just building up mass, building up some muscle that?
Well, young, you know, I was a young man, so growing over the years in different weight classes. And honestly, I probably should have been a 132 pounder.
Okay.
But I always felt comfortable and strong in my weight class.
Mm-hmm.
And my coach always, he always encouraged me, you know, go, you know, if you want to go up, you feel strong. And I was knocking people out. He said, let's do it. So that's what I ended up doing. But honestly, my frame and my size at the time, I probably should have been a 132, maybe 139.
Okay.
I fought Vernon Forrest at 139. I beat him twice. And he, this guy was like 6 foot tall, very lean and muscular and had a really good style and was a great person. I was, so humbled and honored to grace the ring with him. Our third time he beat me though. So he beat me a split decision.
Oh.
And I remember after that fight, again, kind of being hurt and wounded. I was so excited. I was going to make the Olympics. My vision was to make the Olympics at 139 pounds. So here I am. Vernon Forrest was, him and I were kind of favored to go at a 139. We were invited to elite training camps. They had their eyes on us and I beat him twice. So I'm like so excited. And then he beat me that third time and I was devastated. And I took some time off and I gained some weight. So for the next tournament, I didn't have enough time to lose that weight.
Mm.
But then I started knocking everybody out at 147. Again, I shouldn't have fought. I wasn't a 147 pound fighter. I was walking around at 143 and I should have totally went back to 139. But then my coach said, champ, you're knocking everybody out. Let's stay at 147. So that's what I did. I ended up staying at the 147.
Gotcha. Was there more or less competition in 139 versus 147?
Well, I would say 139 was loaded with talent. Vernon Forrest, Oba Carr, Ross Thompson. These were guys that all of them became Steve Johnston, Tyrone Mallett. Every single one of those individuals that I've named have become world champions. And we were all stacked up in that weight class. So it was a very tough weight class. I would say that Vernon and I were on the top. But it was stacked. Welterweight was tough though too. It had some good individuals there as well. But I would say actually on Facebook, there's this group, 1992, or 89 to 92 USA boxers. And they have said that 139 weight class was the toughest weight class in the history of amateur boxing.
Wow.
And I was part of it.
That's cool. So do you still, just out of curiosity here, do you still go to the gym boxing?
I used to own a fitness franchise called Nine Round in Oak Creek. And that was a great way of giving back. You know, we help train individuals. I'll hold the pad for them and help work them out. And I work out myself. But I sold that business a few years ago. I always go to the gym when my coach, Shorty, the Giant, wants me to talk to the kids. And I love doing that, sharing with them my experiences, what it takes to be a champion, both in and out of the ring.
Sure.
And my coach really taught us that was actually more important to be a champion out of the ring than it is in the ring. So he loves when I can talk to the kids about that. And then the third thing is, so I'm on the newly elected vice president of the USA Olympic Boxing Board. So on a national level, I get to be a part of an organization that helped create the champion that I am today and really give back to a sport that is creating other champions, again, both in and out of the ring.
That's cool. So one thing, because you're, I guess, what I would consider to be a real experienced boxer, I want to ask you a question about boxing. You can tell me if you don't want to answer it, if it's not safe to answer it, right? How... Or was there any fixing of fights around you going on? or with people betting and stuff like that? Or was that, I guess, was that, were you not at that level, or I don't know, maybe that's not a thing. That's just a movie thing.
Sure. No, there's betting. There's betting. But, you know, the fixing of fights, not so much of that, but it's more that there's politics and there's favorites. So that's part of it. That's part of boxing, no matter if it's amateur, it's professional. That's a factor. And there are many boxers who have felt, look, man, I should have won that fight. But they like the other guy. That exists. That does exist in boxing. I'd say it's gotten better and less of that over the years because of the rigorous training that that officials receive now and the scoring system where it's electronic. So it's all point scoring system. So I think it's gotten much, much better over the years, but there's still, you know, some politics involved.
Sure. Okay. That's fair. Are you, I'm just trying to think what I want to ask here. It's so funny because I think when you're in boxing and they're scoring, a lot of times, I guess when I've been in the ring, just way amateur, your brain is so, you're just moving so fast.
Yeah.
And just talking with other fighters in the amateur fights, a lot of times they don't know if they won or not. They're so just focused on the instant, on the moment. Not necessarily in the whole fight. And so it's fun. It's kind of fun talking to him because we would watch this as spectators. Sure. There's one actually last fall, kind of close to town. It was kind of cool. I trained with the guy that was in the fight. And he's like, how do you think I did? Because he had no clue. So it was interesting when it's not a clear knockout or something like that. Was that your experience where you don't know? Or were there times you thought, I totally won that? And
yeah. I think when you're earlier in your career, it's like that, where things are kind of a blur. But as you get better and you learn more on the sport and you develop more skills, then you know if you won the fight or not. But, you know, and sometimes, I mean, there's been several fights. I like Vernon Forrest, I thought I beat him, right? And three judges scored it for him, two scored it for me. So there's lots of times where you think you won the fight. And in all honesty, you know, maybe you thought you won the fight, but maybe you really didn't. You know, you might think a little bit more of yourself than the actual outcome, what the actual outcome should be. But yeah, I think with more experience, you kind of get a good sense of what the reality is.
Okay. So so let's say you quit boxing. What did you decide was your next step?
Yeah, so I that was a very hard decision. And so here I am, I'm 20 years old. And I said, I got to go back to school and develop a career for myself. And I recall where I went to a technical college first and I had to take an entrance exam and I scored really low, embarrassingly low. And I had to take basic arithmetic courses and some very basic courses. And quickly I realized that was too easy for me. But I kind of felt bad that I didn't take school more seriously. I always felt I was smart. And if I wanted to get a 3-point, sometimes I would put the attention. But most of the time, you know, boxing was my life and my career. I was traveling all over the world. And I knew I had aspirations to become a professional boxer. I always did want to go back to school, but it just wasn't my focus. But now it had to be. And so I ended up taking some very basic courses. And then I actually stopped a semester because I got so involved with the church and immersed myself and wanted to learn more about Jesus. But then that following semester, I came back and I told the guidance counselor, I said, look, those classes were too easy. I want to take the regular courses. At that time, I wanted to get into physical therapy, which ended up turning into occupational therapy. And at first he said, no, you can't. You got to take the progression of courses. And I said, well, I don't know what I did, but I ended up convincing her. And I ended up taking the courses and I ended up graduating with honors. And I ended up my master's degree at 3.83. I was the only student in my class to publish my thesis in the American Journal of Occupational Therapy. So this is where boxing came in, the dedication, determination, and discipline, but also those virtues, magnanimity. When I was boxing, I wasn't boxing to be number two. 10 years of boxing, only 3 of those years I wasn't rated number one in the country. I was fighting with the intensity and tenacity of being number one. And so I brought that same mentality into school. You know, a B, a C wasn't good enough. My A was my standard, and I was fighting and striving for that. So the virtue of magnanimity and really striving for greatness was something I pursued in my education as well.
Nice. So what was your first job out of school?
Yeah, so I started off as a mental health clinician. So in occupational therapy, you can work in a hospital system, you can work in geriatrics, outpatient, mental health, pediatrics, gerontology. But I was really interested in working for a hospital system. And my goal was to gain experience and then have my own business, specifically relating to individuals that were Latinos and Spanish speaking. So I felt that that could be my niche in the market, but there weren't, the job market was saturated at that time. So those hospital jobs really didn't exist. So then I got into mental health, and I was always interested in mental health because I have a sister who has bipolar disorder. And I saw the challenges that she experienced with addiction, severe persistent mental illness, being in and out of jail and in and out of the psychiatric hospital and attempted suicide attempts and fights between her and my mother. And so I always had an interest in that. And so that's where I started at Wisconsin Correctional Services, where I started off as a mental health clinician, but then within 3 months, I became their assistant director.
Wow. What do you attribute that to?
Just a passion that I had and ideas that I had relating to doing better for the people that we serve. And we played a significant role there in reintegrating individuals that came from jail back into the community, or reintegrating individuals that came from long-term care institutions. And I think the passion obviously came from my sister and the experiences I saw with her growing up, and the passion that I had with just really trying to increase health and well-being from others around me. And I also have to say that I learned so much from my mother. So my mother and father got a divorce when I was 12 years old, and my father moved to Puerto Rico, didn't send us money, didn't call us. And I saw my mother be a humble servant leader, working 2 and sometimes 3 jobs to support the family, having to face with the challenges of my sister all by herself. But not only that, but also serving others in the community. I mean, we would feed the homeless, and my sister would have some boyfriends that had mental illnesses, and my mother would take them grocery shopping and make sure that they took their medications and basically would do everything a paid case manager would do for them. And I learned that humble service. I learned how wonderful my mother was to so many others, and the way she gave back, even though we struggled ourselves. We grew up in poverty. I remember one time, one of my best friends who ended up dying due to drug overdose came over, and right away my mother said, hey, there was one pork chop left and some rice and beans, and make sure you share that pork chop and rice and beans with DJ. And so we learned how to be giving like that through my mother. So I want to say that my mother has had a huge influence in my life and in terms of the person that I am today.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. So you start running this place. How long did you run that space?
So the community support program, I did that for 3 years.
Okay.
And then I went to the United Community Center as the associate executive director. where I oversaw their elderly programs. And that was a great place to be because I consider myself a product of the United Community Center, going back through the boxing and baseball programs. Then I branched off into government. So I worked for Mayor Barrett as a lobbyist. I worked for Governor Doyle in various leadership capacities. And this is where I stretched myself. So I never had any lobbying experience when I joined the mayor, and yet I was able to get more legislation passed compared to a team of 4 to 5 individuals. Over 2 sessions combined, I was able to do in 1 year. But again, I brought passion and I worked really hard. If people give me an opportunity, I want to make them proud. And in this case, Mayor Barrett gave me an opportunity maybe I wasn't qualified for actually at the time. You know, there was this alderman who said, "Hey, I think you're a nice guy. I saw your resume, but I don't think you're qualified for this position. And this is one of the most important positions we have in city government. I don't know what Mayor Barrett is thinking." Yeah, I don't know what Mayor Barrett is thinking. And, you know, I didn't get mad. It actually motivated me to prove to the guy, and also to thank the mayor for having the confidence in me to be a lobbyist. I'm with one of the aldermen saying that this was one of the most important positions we have in city government, and being really effective in that role while I was there. So that was very humbling. Then here I am. I have a master's degree in occupational therapy. I get tapped by Governor Doyle to be the director of economic development for WIDA, which is the second largest bank by way of assets in the state of Wisconsin. I don't have an MBA. I don't have a finance background. I don't have a banking background. And yet I'm given this incredible opportunity. But I worked really hard. I remember going to one of my first meetings and with the board of directors and them speaking about financial statements and new market tax credits and low income housing tax credits. And it was kind of like they were speaking French, and I didn't fully understand everything they were saying, but I jotted down notes and I ended up taking financial courses, commercial real estate courses at UW-Madison, and surrounding myself with, you know, developing relationships with bank CEOs and executives. And while I was there, due to my incredible team, we have the most loan guarantees that in the history of WIDA. While I was there, we increased our revenue substantially by a 30% while I was there. Wow. And so we did incredible things. So again, I think the keys there is surround yourself with talent, but be hungry in your learning, and make sure that you're trying to be the best you possibly can be. Then I went on to other government jobs under the Doyle administration, continued to grow in capacity, which was wonderful. And that led me to the Director of Health and Human Services in Milwaukee County, where I got to work under Chris Abley. And that was just an incredible experience. I would recommend a government job like that, overseeing a major department. You know, if you want to grow in humility and in leadership, I would recommend going through that experience. It was really hard.
Nice. So yeah. I got to have you back up a little step here because right. I had no idea that mayors had lobbyists.
Yes.
So what are they lobbying for, the city to the state?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so the state legislature to enact laws that would be beneficial to the city. You know, I was involved with real estate laws, economic development laws, health and human needs laws, and so the creation of laws, but then also making sure that the city receives the resources they need to be successful as the major city in the state. The better the city does, the better the state will do. So basically trying to articulate that case to others that might not be part of Milwaukee, but still can see how the benefits when Milwaukee does well, the rest of the state does well.
Sure. So lobbying to me has always been one of those, is this art or science kind of thing?
Oh, well.
So can you explain to both myself and the listeners, what does a lobbyist do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So really it is an art and a science, I'd say. It's really about understanding the issues well, being able to articulate them well in front of the right people. So, you know, when I was there, John Gard was the speaker, and he's a Republican, and I developed a really good relationship with him. And then, you know, I would say, who do you want me to go to on the Democratic side? And he would tell me, and then I'd do that. So it's, and then it's not only going to the right people, but it's also developing coalitions of support that can also support you, especially in our case, individuals that are outside of the city of Milwaukee. So it's about developing those coalitions, going to the right people, and being very articulate and focused on your message, because many of these individuals don't have a lot of time. Mm. So you want to make sure that you position yourself effectively in front of them while you have their time. So that's, you know, it's basically going to those people and articulating your case. Sometimes you go in front of committees. They'll invite you in front of a committee to share your thoughts about things like that. It's really about relationships.
That's cool. That's interesting. So I guess given your background, especially in politics, would you ever consider running for mayor or congressman or president or something like that?
You know, I had that experience. I feel like I've been there, done that. It's been incredible. I really loved it. But, you know, I've done my purgatory. I think I'm past that. And, you know, I really enjoy this side of it. At the executive level, I feel that we can accomplish more, especially at Lutheran Social Services, where we are impacting over 30,000 lives on an annual basis. 91% of those individuals have indicated that we've improved the quality of life. So I can have that type of impact, and then be at the CEO level where I could be surrounded with a team that can influence and guide an organization for greatness. Man, I love it. I love it. I love it on this side. So I don't envision myself going back, actually.
That's cool.
But we'll continue to be part of the process. I want to continue to be part of the process and speak on behalf of good, worthy causes and hopefully influence people. You know what I want to do?
Yeah.
I want to influence people to live out the virtues that are laid out in my book. And that's magnanimity, which is striving for greatness, humility, serving others, courage, facing your fears and fighting to do the right thing, even when it's unpopular. That's hard in government. Mm-hmm. Perseverance, not giving up, but also allowing us to fail. In government, you can't fail. You get crucified, which is really unfortunate, because failure really allows you to grow and really allows you to achieve extraordinary things. And temperance. We need more temperance and self-control and self-restraint in government. So I want to influence government through the framework of those virtues that are outlined in my book.
So I want you to tell us more about temperance, because mm-hmm. that, I guess I understand a lot of the first ones, but temperance, I feel like me personally, I could probably learn something from that. So just,
absolutely.
I guess, walk me through how you define it and just talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So self-control, restraint. Now, I'll give you a couple different ways of looking at it in different settings. So here I am in my role as a president and CEO. So, you know, there's lots of challenge that come in this role. And there may be some people that say certain things that might not be so nice. And so if you exhibit temperance, you'll think about that situation. What was just said? and you'll reflect on that instead of bursting out and saying something that you might regret. So you might reflect on it. You might even sleep over it. And then the next day, approach it in a way with temperance, maybe with love, with care and compassion versus with anger. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way is, your own, we all have temperaments, and we might have certain personality traits and styles and approaches. And sometimes, obviously, that's how God made us, right? And many of that is really, really, really positive, which is wonderful. But we have our weaknesses. And so sometimes you want to just be thoughtful and reflect and not let your weaknesses come out. And just be more, you might want to practice mindfulness and say, okay, one thing I do at the end of the night is I do what I call is an examination of conscience. So I ask myself, what did I do well today? And I analyze and I focus on that. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And I want to repeat that tomorrow, right? And I'm grateful of those things I did well. And I give myself a little pat on the back, and that's wonderful. I want to continue to do that. But then I also ask myself, what didn't I do very well today? And I try to go deep. Like, what was the root of why I said that? I reacted that way. I try to go to the root, because that's what's going to help me not do that thing again tomorrow. So I reflect on that, and then I pray and I say, Lord, help me not do that again tomorrow. And now I understand better why I did that, and I'm embarrassed of that. And tomorrow I'm trying to make a commitment to myself. Tomorrow I'm not going to do that again. And I might ask for forgiveness as well for an individual. So temperance is really self-control. Restraint is very important. Mm-hmm. Especially think about our political environment, where there's these little sound bites and there's a tweet and everybody's offending one another. And it's really unfortunate that one issue could divide us so much. Mm-hmm. I believe that the Republicans and the Democrats should not compromise their values. That's who they are. But don't let one issue divide us. Mm-hmm. How can, there are so many issues, I believe, that are in the middle, in the center, that people can agree on, but mm-hmm. oftentimes won't, because of the divisiveness, the polarization, the anger that exists in our political system. And I think it's frustrating.
It's definitely frustrating. It's interesting. I look on even social media of friends that I have that lean what I would consider to be an extreme on one side or the other, and I've both. Yep. And you see them calling, like, if you don't believe what I believe, then you're stupid or you're dumb or something like that, where you're essentially insulting someone's intelligence for believing something that arguably 40% of the population believes.
Yeah. So
is that dumb necessarily, or they just have a different perspective? So it's weird how it's resorted to almost name calling, and it's frustrating to watch. I think it's not advancing as a society like it should, from my point of view.
I agree with you. I think we could be a much greater country if we respect each other's differences. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them.
No,
not at all. But at least you listen. You have empathy and understanding for someone's background and their thoughts and opinions. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but and then you share yours. And I guarantee you that there's more you will agree on than you will disagree. But in our polarizing environment and our political divisive environment that we're in right now, we need bigger champions out there. Mm-hmm. We need better leaders out there that are gonna say enough is enough, mm-hmm. and we can do better. And we have the greatest country, in the world, I would say, but it's still imperfect, mm-hmm. and we still can be better. We should strive for magnanimity. We should strive for greatness, and we're capable of it, but we need people to stand up and get that done.
Yeah, there's a long way to go. It's interesting when I don't know, I'd call it 5-10 years ago, from my travels and stuff like that, I was thinking, we got a good thing going here. But now I look around at just little things here and there, and I'm like, it's 2020. Why don't we have this fixed? We could have some of the stuff taken care of, right? And we don't. And it's not even on the burner, let alone the back burner. Yeah. So it's interesting how we've we're still trying to fix stuff that should have been fixed decades ago. But
yes,
here we are. So
hey, but
no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was gonna say, but you have a platform, man. So let's do this.
I bring on
one person at a time.
Yeah, you know, the goal, you bring on thought leaders like you to share their knowledge and their experience. It can't hurt. Mm-hmm. Right? It certainly can't hurt to give a channel or to offer a little bit of a soapbox for people like you to present what they have going on. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's smart, it's thoughtful, it's helpful. And I feel like that's, I want to say rare. As many times as I hear people say that they want to help people, I see a lot more people, I don't, just circling the drain somewhat from just negativity. Maybe it's not even intentional on a conscious level. But it's just, there's a lot of negativity. You can just feel a tension since, I don't know, February, March, something like that. There's just this tension for, people are on edge. So I think they need to relax, make progress.
So right now is a really, really challenging time. So here we're faced with this pandemic, which we haven't seen ever in our life. And there's lots of anxiety and people's lives have been disrupted and jobs mm-hmm. have been lost and mm-hmm. anxiety is increasing and domestic violence and homicide. I mean, this is a tough time. Then you throw on top of that, just the civil unrest relating to George Floyd. And mm-hmm. and it's a really hard time in our in our country, in our lives. And like I said, now more than ever, we need good people to stand up. And let's do something good for our country and let's work together on it. You know, black, white, brown, and in between, let's all of us unite for the common good of each other and in our country. And it's possible. It's possible.
Yeah, I was talking about the whole pandemic thing with my wife. And I'm like, it's interesting because you see two different perspectives, generally speaking, two different perspectives on how people feel we should react to the pandemic. And her and I are pretty severely divided on that. I'm like, in the end, both of us want the same thing. You want a nation where people feel free. You want a nation where people are happy. You want a nation of opportunity. You want to be able to go down the street and feel healthy and not feel like it's a challenge or feel, you don't want to feel fear. Just, you know, going for a jog or something like that. Like we all want the same thing. We just feel individually like there's different means to achieve that goal. And I think if we keep our eye on the prize more, maybe that would help us unite. At least I hope it would a little bit rather than figuring out the individual day to day.
You're absolutely right. It's just, I think it all starts with listening, you know, being, you know, better listeners. You know, I'm big on servant leadership. Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote an article about equity, diversity, and inclusion through the lens of a servant leadership approach. And what I'm saying here is that we should focus on the tenets of servant leadership. And the ones I focus on were awareness, listening, healing, and the growth and development of your people. And in the article, I say that we should move towards leadership over legislation, awareness over assumptions, and culture over compliance, because their traditional approaches to equity, diversity, inclusion haven't worked. I'm gonna hire a person, I'm gonna require training, I'm gonna change a policy. Those are technical aspects to an adaptive issue. Mm-hmm. And so I recently wrote an article on that, and I got a lot of people from the business community, nonprofit community, and just lots of people saying, wow, this is great. And so at LSS, we're not experts. We're just going to use that servant leadership philosophy, though, to really guide our process. And really, it's about serving others, listening, and all those other characteristics I just shared.
Sure. That's cool. So, Hector, your memoir, you said people can go to your website. Can you repeat that website again where people can find it in order?
Thank you so much. Hector Colon, Colon, MKE.com. So that's my personal website. You can access the book from there. And that's where it is.
Nice. That is awesome. I appreciate you being on the show here, Hector.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, James. I'm glad to be on the show with you, and maybe look forward to being on the show again. And definitely when I'm in your side of town, I would love to maybe have coffee.
Oh, anytime. This has been Authentic Business Adventures, the business program that brings you the struggle stories and triumphant successes of business owners across the land, coming to you remotely, because that's how we got to do it now. But we're also underwritten by the Bank of Sun Prairie through the Sun Prairie Community Radio Center. My name is James Kademan, and Authentic Business Adventures is brought to you by Calls on Call, offering call answering services for small businesses across the country on the web at callsoncall.com, as well as Draw In Customers Business Coaching, offering business coaching services for entrepreneurs in all stages of their business on the web at drawincustomers.com. And of course, the Bold Business Book, a book for the entrepreneur in all of us, available on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. We'd like to thank you, our wonderful listeners, as well as our guest, Hector Colon, President and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan, as well as 7-time national boxing champion. Hector, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
It's been great. I am looking forward to reading your memoir.
Appreciate it. And look forward to meeting you in person.
Absolutely. Find us airing on 103.5 Wednesdays at 1 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m., as well as at sunprairiemediacenter.com. Past episodes can be found morning, noon, and night at the podcast link, found at drawincustomers.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. I want you to stay awesome. And if you do nothing else, enjoy your business.